You have in your hands a book entitled Revolutionary Bible Study and the CD in the back of it. The title is Four Wrong Ways to Study the New Testament. But there's much more implied here than that. Revolutionary Bible study implies also that Bible study previously has not been revolutionary. But it goes even deeper than that. This book is the first book of its kind ever written. And the fact that it has taken that long to come up with a new approach to studying the New Testament is nothing less than shocking. The potential is nothing less than the revolutionary, the revolutionizing of our faith. Now, what's been going on that was wrong? I want to trace back the roots of that, and then we'll move forward and see just how much is implied in what we're facing. I want you to go back to about the year 260 AD. There were very few manuscripts floating around at that time, but someone had the 13 letters of Paul, which were, by the way, the first ones that were to emerge that archaeologists can tell us about, and the ones most frequently reproduced. This gentleman walked into a bookbinder and said, I would like to have Paul's 13 letters bound together. What happened after that moment was the greatest single tragedy and stumbling block ever to take place in all the history of Christendom. All else pales in the presence of the disaster that took place when that bookbinder got a hold of those 13 letters. Now, he had a heathen mind. He had a pagan way of looking at binding books. It was what they were doing in those days. If you were to walk into that same bookbinder and ask Aristotle's works to be bound together, well, they automatically would put the longest treatise of Aristotle first, then the second, then the third, then the fourth. The same would be of Cicero, of Pliny, or of Homer. It didn't matter. You always took the first place as the for the that which was the longest. Now, there's a reason for that, and that is because those treatises were not so much history. Or at least every writer would write on a different subject, and those subjects were not connected. Aristotle would write on something like how to make speech. We call it rhetoric. And then he would write on something else about government. Paul's letters were treated the same way. All of them were treated as though they were not connected to one another. And yet the truth of the matter is that Paul's letters are more uniquely connected to one another than all the other writings of the New Testament combined. Anyway, he looked the letters over and decided correctly that Paul's longest letter was Romans. Forget the fact that it was not Paul's first letter. It was his longest letter. The bookbinder then looked at to find what would be the second longest, and he measured correctly. It was 1 Corinthians, then 2 Corinthians. And then the next one was Galatians, although I'm told he probably missed it by one word. Ephesians might have had one word more in it. It doesn't really matter. The tragedy was building. Then came Philippians and Colossians. And then, to give you some idea how big a mess that was, the next letters that were sewn together were, in fact, some of Paul's earliest letters. It went all the way to 2 Timothy, which is the last letter Paul ever wrote. But it's not the last of the 13 letters that were bound together. The last one was Philemon. And why was it last? Because it was shortest. Now, from that day forward, all of Paul's letters have been published by length and for 1,800 years. No one has ever questioned doing that. Or if they have, they haven't done it very seriously. Or at very best, and I do believe I own the world's first chronological New Testament, and it was in the late 1800s. It did not sell. In the last 20 years, we have seen a few New Testaments put out. But basically, all they did was to rearrange Paul's letters in their proper order. Those also have not sold. There's been no reason for anyone understanding why we put them, those letters together chronologically. Now, let's see if I can explain this. You're familiar with the three letters of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. There is virtually nothing in them that gives you any idea as to when they were written, to whom they were written, or where. The book of James, not a clue, no history in it. Jude, a total mystery. 1st Peter, quite a bit. 2nd Peter, absolutely no understanding whatsoever. Of the setting, the context, the content. Yeah, the context, that is the surroundings. This is not true of Paul's letters. When you put them in their proper order, they're like a chain brought together, and they tell a story. A story that reaches from the year 50 to the year 63. Which just so happens to be also the years when most of the New Testament was written. Now, what I'm about to say to you is a little difficult to grasp, and it's something we seem to have totally overlooked. The book of Acts is a history book. Paul's letters are epistles, or they are letter books. History books, and they're letter books. There's a world of difference. The first four letter books of the New Testament are biographical. The next one is historical. That's the book of Acts. But we tend to forget that Acts was not written in the year 30 or 40 or even 50. Acts was probably written by Luke and somewhere around the year 63 A.D., which means that Luke, writing Acts, had already read many of Paul's letters before he wrote Acts. He knew the context of at least six of the letters that he had written by the time he closed Luke, closed the book of Acts. For instance, take the book of Galatians. Luke read Galatians long before he wrote Acts, and when he got to the area where Acts and Galatians came together, he went out of his way to clarify the background to Galatians, and we don't know that. At least we don't know it unless we should stop and say, at this point in Acts, Paul wrote Galatians. So, 2 points here. We've got to take Paul's letters out of length to chronological order, that is the sequence in which he wrote them. And then, at least up until the year 63, we need to look at every point in Acts, identify that point where Paul wrote a letter. When we do that, a beautiful, sequential, contextual story begins to emerge that gives us insights we have never, never previously had.
as to Paul's letters, and consequently, to a large part of the New Testament.
That's what should have happened back in about 300 AD. Someone should have put Paul's letters together in the order in which he wrote them, but they never did. So I would like to acquaint you with what did happen, and will help you understand why we have ended up with four wrong ways to study the New Testament and have not had a proper way to study Paul's letters, nor even a large part of the New Testament. There are 14 books out of 27 books of the New Testament that come together to give us a story that reaches all the way from the year 30 AD to the year 68 AD. Everything happened during that period that we would call of greatest consequence. Now, folks, most of the New Testament was written also during that same time. In fact, all of the New Testament was written somewhere between the years 30 and 70 AD, with the possible exception of Revelation. So it behooves us to know what happened between the year 30 and the year 70 AD. And Paul's letters fall within 30 to 68 AD. Those 2 years, by the way, are very easy to fill in. But let's go back. We now have circulating in the Roman Empire Paul's letters written by length. There is no connection between the letters. Therefore, each letter is treated as a standalone. Now, let's add another ingredient. Let's say it's the year 300 AD. Paul's letters are circulating. They are circulating where? They are circulating in the Roman Empire. Now, put yourself in that era, and if you were an educated person during that period of time, you would be exposed to the one and only kind of education that existed in that day, and that was a Greek education. And the heart and soul of a Greek education was a philosophical education. If you were to learn anything in the Greek way of educating the human mind, it would be primarily philosophy. You would study Homer, who was a storyteller, but mostly you would study Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and a few other lesser lights such as Zeno, and I'll not mention the rest of them, that's enough. Each of these men wrote treatises, shall we call them books, that were standalone. They had no father, no mother, no brother, no sister. Each one of them stood alone. Now, here comes Paul's letters. Here, educated people, educated in the Greek world. There are 13 letters by Paul, and they don't make any sense whatsoever as it concerns their being connected. And of course, the one that's leading the 13 is the book of Romans, which, by the way, just as bad luck would have it, was the only letter Paul ever wrote that was mostly a treatise. So now comes the Greek mind. Here's a Greek that is saturated in the writings and the education of a Western man. He gets converted to Christ and he comes to the book of Romans. He looks at it. He treats it as a philosophical work. And with his intellectual, logical linear mind. He takes that book apart almost as though it had no soul, no context, no surrounding whatsoever. And he overlays his philosophical mind on top of the book of Romans.
Now, dear child of God, that's the way Romans has been treated till this very day. I am a student of and a graduate of, hold on your hat and don't think poorly of me, of basically a Greek education. Or to put it another way, I'm a seminary graduate. And it's amazing what we could do even with a simple little book like Philemon and turn that into a philosophical, and then gradually over the passing of centuries, it became something new, the daughter of philosophy, which was theology. You take a little book like Philemon, it's got less than 30 sentences in it, and what do you come up with? Philosophy, theology, a soulless, cold-blooded, intellectual, logical, didactic look at a very passionate, beautiful letter. And so there grew up the first wrong way to study the Bible, or the New Testament. And that was the study of Paul's letters from a philosophical and later theological viewpoint. Context was not even considered. All those people mentioned at the end, something that was lost to us. From, say, verse 8 all the way to the end, except for chapter 16, we have a theological treatise. The soul is gone. 1 Corinthians, well, there's some personal things in there, mention of some people who lived in certain places and certain things they did. Most of it's at the end of the letter, most of it's in the last 8 or 10 sentences, but the philosophical, the theological. And so it was, we began to study all of Paul's letters in a totally theological way. There was some redeeming grace and mercy there. There were no chapters and there were no verses. And there were not very many educated people. Most folks were illiterate. And all writings had to be done by hand, which was enormously expensive. So most of the treaties of that day and era had only one or two copies and were lost to us. About the only ones that survived in large number were writings by, I'm being correct here, there were many others that survived, but not in large number, were the writings of Tertullian and a gentleman by the name of Origen, and there was a reason for that. Origen had an extremely wealthy man backing everything Origen wrote. He had an entire room full of scribes making copies of Origen's writings and paid some people then to not only copy those letters, or I'm sorry, philosophical treatises, but to distribute them throughout the Roman Empire. So we've ended up with Origen and Tertullian, both of them with a strong Greek background. Although Origen wrote in Greek, Tertullian wrote in Latin, it still comes out the same way. And so, we were not too cursed with too much writings of that day until about 1200, when the church stepped in with its money
and began backing their, in a large way, the writings of a gentleman by the name of Thomas Aquinas, referred to by his students as the bull, because he had such a large neck. And out of the coffers of the Roman Catholic Church, his books were hand-copied and distributed throughout the domain of the Roman Catholic Church. And so there grew up the philosophical, the theological marriage of the writings of Paul, in which every one of Paul's letters were standalone theological treaties. Then about 1205, from a young man named Stephanus, chapters were added. Well, between handwriting and nothing more than chapters being added, we were not in too bad a shape. So began to emerge the second wrong way to study the New Testament. The words of Paul are still in a completely pagan arrangement that is by length. Then, in 1455, the printing press was invented, and by the year 1500, nobody was handwriting books, they were being printed. Then came the Reformation and the second wrong way to study the New Testament. Now, in a 1560, around 1556, someone, a printer, decided to add little numbers to each sentence so that we could find the sentences. So the sentences ceased to exist, and it became called, their name was verses. By the way, ironically, this gentleman's name was also Stephanus. 1205 and 1556. We have first the chapters, and then we have the numerical numbers. And we have the printing press, and now we have the Reformation. And now we have a flood of theological, philosophical interpretations of Paul's letters, always stand alone because they're always arranged exactly the way they're arranged in your New Testament. Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, then 1 Thessalonians, then 2 Thessalonians, then 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, and then Philemon. What a mess. What an absolutely chaotic mess. Now, I'm going to add a personal word here. In the book that you have read or about to read, I use the term chaotic and bizarre, and even the word insane in addressing the crazy way those 16 letters are arranged. Not so much that they're arranged that way, but that it has taken 1,800 years with anybody saying, let's stop this madness and arrange those letters in their proper way. Forgive me if those words sound strong to you, but I have been reading my New Testament chronologically for over 4 decades, and I am awed, shocked, bewildered, that we would let such chaos reign and what could be the key to a whole new dimension of understanding the New Testament. Well, what happened in the Reformation was the same thing that happened previous to it, except in massive amounts. We now had printing presses. Anyone who could pay a printer and could sit down and write a treatise could immediately become popular because he had some philosophical view of one of Paul's letters. And the entire European continent and the British Isles were drenched with new writings that were not conforming to the Roman Catholic Church. So we now have two theologies growing up, the Roman Catholic and the Protestant, but they're all philosophical, theological, and they're treating Paul's letters, every one of them, as standalones. You cannot find a book anywhere in the Reformation period that once addresses context. Not a single sense ever written about the proper order of Paul's letters, nor the enormous radical change that takes place when you put them together and they stand up and say, we have a story to tell. So the second wrong way to read the New Testament is very much like the first one, except it's a Protestant view, very argumentative and still basically Greek in its mentality. Now we come to the evangelical era when we are told constantly to get into the Bible and understand the New Testament and be faithful to it. Now I'm going to make a rash, radical statement that I wish you would not quote me on because it's a great statement to take out of context. I don't care how many times you've read the New Testament, in the order it's arranged, you cannot possibly understand what it is saying. Memorize it in the original language, Greek. Learn to say it in Greek. But as long as those letters are arranged in the chaotic order that they are in, there are certain things that will not emerge. And therefore you are denied access to a large part of the understanding of the New Testament. And by the way, I am not speaking theologically. I'm speaking of the discovery of the practice of the first century church. I'm speaking of the emergence of the story of what happened in the first century that has always been denied us. And in a few minutes, I will address the matter of a model, M-O-D-E-L, which we've never even thought of. Maybe you're used to the term if you've ever studied evolution and creationist. Each of them demand the other one produce a model because everything took back somewhere in the primordial era. And astronomers, mathematicians, anyone that has to do with physics and science always demand, give us a model. And we have never had a model of the first century. Rather, instead, we have built what the church is by gathering together verses at our whim, at our capricious grasp, and we're saying that's how it was in the first century. But it's all verses, and it's all human conjecture. Whereas the story itself awaits us. The story is clear, and it radically changes everything. Well, I'm going to now tell you about the third wrong way to read the New Testament,
And this is the first time that I have ever heard anyone tell us of this way. It's a shameful way. It's an embarrassing way to study the New Testament. It's the kind of thing you would want to hide under a rock or keep it under the bed, but not let anybody discover what it is. And yet it is universally the most practiced way of studying the New Testament. It has no name. I'll just describe it. It's you. And you open the book of Romans and Corinthians, and then Ephesians or Colossians, and it doesn't make any sense to you, but the writings are beautiful, and every once in a while you find this beautiful sentence, now called a verse. It's got a little number on it. And you grab your pen and you underline it. And you think, wow, that's so beautiful. That is so beautiful. Love conquers all things. Love is faithful. Love endures. Romans 8, neither things past nor present nor anything created shall separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. No context, no understanding of why that was written, but we got a numbered sentence and we underline it. And that's how we fulfill the demand made upon us by preachers that we get into the Word, that it's impossible for you to grow as a Christian without, it's the Word, it's the Word of God, it's the Bible, study it, study it, study it. Now, I'm going to confess something for all of us. Paul's epistles don't make a bit of sense, but we study them and we read them and we underline them. Revolutionary Bible study has changed all of that. You're about to find the story. You're going to discover the provocation for every way, reason, every context, every behind-the-scenes crisis that caused Paul to write each one of those letters. And you put them in the order Paul wrote them, and they rise up and tell you the first century story. By the way, that's the fifth way to read the New Testament. Now, it is my unhappy task to tell you that there is a fourth way. It was invented by a gentleman by the name of John Dorby, and it is the other most popular way to study the New Testament. And if studying Paul's letters by length was bizarre, wait till you see what John Nelson Dorby did with the whole New Testament. That is really bizarre. And I would like to tell you that he lived around, let's just say around 1840. It's a good midterm time for him. He probably would have been one of the great mathematical geniuses of all time. He found something nobody had ever found in the Bible. He found seven dispensations. And within each one of those dispensations, he found another seven elements. For instance, you and I live in the sixth dispensation, the dispensation of the church. But there are seven churches. The seventh one is the Church of Laodicea, and it's the one God spewed out of his mouth. So John Darby said, God is through with the church. The age of the church is over. Forget the church. It's irredeemable. And we all kind of believed him, and it became very popular in the Bible schools, which were emerging just around the years 1850 to the years 1930, and his writings were so popular. That's why you have heard it said the age of the apostles is past. He dispensationalized the apostles out of existence. But Mr. John Darby, when you got rid of the apostles and the prophets,
He forgot to tell us what was to take their place. You never told us, and so we have been lost and left, without a ship, without a compass, and without a rudder. And we're floating around in the seventh dispensation, without a church, and with nothing but your writings to tell us what to do. And folks, what John Darby ended up himself doing was starting chapels where everyone could sit around and hold your breath, study the writings of John Darby. So perhaps that was the will of God, to get rid of the church, and we'll spend the rest of the time until Jesus comes studying the writings of John Darby. Well, folks, believe it or not, almost everything that you preach today in a strong fundamental church has strong overtones of John Darby writings. And this is what I would like to say. John Darby knew absolutely nothing about the order in which Paul wrote those letters and had no historical context for any of them. Put those letters together, find out that they are filled with personal references, filled with surroundings, filled with context, and suddenly you've got a revolution on your hands. So as you read the book, you're going to find a context in which Paul was sitting in one place writing his letter to another place. Why he was in that place, what caused him to pick up his pen and write that letter to those people, and what was happening to those people at that moment. And suddenly we begin to get names. And those names appear again a little later and a little bit later, and suddenly we find out Paul was training some workers. We go ahead and we add some dates and we discover, oh my goodness, Paul was transient. He was constantly moving. He was starting churches. He almost never stayed longer than 6 months, and then he left those churches. Unbelievable. How could these things be? Then we have some context not only about where Paul was and where he wrote and what was happening where he wrote and to where and what was happening to the churches he wrote to, but we also find out for the very first time that even the history of what was taking place, the events taking place in the Roman Empire at that very time, were playing major influential roles in some cases of what Paul said in those letters. When you finish, you're going to have a beautiful tapestry. It has a beginning and an end. You're not only to discover where he wrote the letter, where he wrote the churches he wrote to, what was happening, but you're going to discover something else that's been totally left out, and that was what was happening between those years when Paul wrote nothing at all. Such is the letter, and the next letter, and the next. And such is Revolutionary Bible Study. And this is what I would like to say to you. We need an army of men and women who will begin teaching the New Testament in its sequence. I foresee a New Testament someday that, oh, this would be radical, wouldn't it? It would blend Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John together. And then it would continue on with Acts, but then it would stop right there where Paul wrote his very first letter, which was not Romans, but Galatians, and give a complete context of why he wrote that letter. And then we'd continue on reading Acts until we came to Paul's next letter, which is 1 Thessalonians, and we'd be able to pinpoint the exact place where Paul wrote that letter. And Luke would be helping us a great deal. Remember, he read that letter long before he wrote Acts. And it would continue on until the year 70 AD, and we would have a beautiful history, and voila. The New Testament would be so clear to us, and those letters would be so clear, we might even put other Bible teachers out of business. I'll just say one word briefly, and that is that most of the Bible classes in homes, most of what we're taught in the Bible in seminaries, leave out a great deal, especially home Bible classes, because there's so much that is controversial. So we're not even in our home Bible classes getting the whole story. Now you have a book in your hand. We'll give you all of the books written in the New Testament, and pretty much in the order they were written, but especially in those living letters so full of, yes, intrigue, so filled with people. You get to know them. They appear and reappear, and you hear a story. And it's just as clear as the Gospels are, the four Gospels. And then you begin to look at all this and say, wait a minute, that's the first century, and it doesn't fit century 21 at all. And in fact, we got a 21st century church that's way off base. Let's go back and do it the way they did it in century 1. So yes, we're on the verge of a revolution here. And yes, I trust you will take this book apart. You'll read it diligently. It is my hope that there'll be two or three more helps that will appear to help you along the way. And I'm hoping that we'll have a whole revival of Bible study, and we can throw away the underlining of these disjointed verses that bless us. And we'll be able to put the New Testament in front of us and read it so clearly that we will be able to look up and see fulfilled before us a promise made long ago that we will need no man to teach us. This New Testament was always easy to read, very gripping, very dramatic, very beautiful, edge of your seat, but we've never known it until now. So, dear reader, get your pen, get some paper, and start reading the whole story. And let's see if it won't change your life the way it has others. And perhaps we'll see a whole army of teachers rise up. And maybe in God's good time, we'll see the church restored the way she once was. Remember, for the first time, we'll have a model to hold up and say, oh, that's what it was like in the first century. Oh, it's not at all like what we have in the 21st century. Now may the Lord Jesus Christ and His Holy Spirit be with you while you read. And when you've finished, I'd love to hear from you. And if it so happens that you have heard this a little late and I have passed away, believe there'll be someone else to receive your letter. So write it to me, even though I were dead, someone will have taken my place here. Toward a day of full and complete restoration of the church and the centrality of Jesus Christ. The Lord Jesus Christ be with your spirit.